We'll hear arguments next in 1690, Parham against J.L. and J.R., minors.
Yes, it sure is.
Lackey, I think you may proceed, but before you proceed, in case you weren't in hearing when I announced it, Mr. Justice Brennan is unavoidably detained for parts of these cases, but will participate in the consideration and decision.
Yes, sir.
On the record, of course. You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case comes to this court from the United States District Court for the Middle District of Georgia. At issue is the constitutionality of a Georgia statute which recognizes the right of parents and guardians to make application for admission of their minor children to state mental health facilities. This lawsuit is predicated upon two grounds. The first ground is that these children have a constitutionally protected right to challenge their parents' decisions as to what medically indicated treatment will be provided to children, and that the challenge statute here, which provides for neither notice nor hearing before hospitalization, deprives them of that right without due process of law. The second ground is that mentally ill children have a constitutional right, when they receive state treatment from the state, to receive that treatment only in the treatment setting which is most appropriate to their condition. This lawsuit was brought by two boys aged 12 and 13 at the time of this litigation. Each had been in a state mental health facility for over 5 years. Each had been admitted under the challenge code section, one by his parents, the other by his guardian of state agency. At the time of the trial of the litigation, we admitted that these two boys, as well as 44 other children who were then in the mental health facilities, could be treated for their condition in other facilities which we considered more appropriate. Two facts which do not appear in the record, but which I want to bring to the court's attention, is that one of the plaintiffs is now deceased, J.L. The other is that some of these children are still in the hospital. The district court, in essence, agreed with the appellees on both grounds, finding that, in fact, the children had a liberty interest and that they were deprived of it by the operation of this statute, and finding that the children had a substantive due process right, which was violated by the operation of the statute. There are, in essence, two issues before the court then. The first is whether these children are entitled to procedural due process rights and whether they receive it under the statute. And the second is whether the children have a right, if they're to receive treatment from the state, to receive that treatment only in the best facility. Turning to the first issue.
I thought earlier you had said something to the effect that the request, the demand was for treatments suitable to their needs or something to that effect. Now, you mean that to be the same as the best treatment available?
The language that the district court used was the treatment setting most appropriate to the child's condition, and we interpret that to being the best, that anything less than the best would not be the most appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Do you read the district court's decree as to the 46 individuals with whom it entered specific instructions as to placement to foreclose the state from simply releasing them entirely?
No, sir. I do not.
I may be getting this case confused with the preceding case. Is there any claim for damages on behalf of the children against the parents?
Yes, sir. The complaint asked for $10,000 damage for each child. The district court did not address that issue.
From the parents?
No, from the state employees.
But they're not asking for damages against their parents for the decisions and actions of the parents?
No, sir. The parents are not parties to this lawsuit. There are, in essence, with respect to the procedural due process issue, three sub-issues, one of which the court itself advanced, that being the question of state action here. The other two are the question of whether a child, in fact, has a liberty interest in this situation, and if a child does have a liberty interest, there is state action, what processes do? Turning first to the liberty interest, we look to the district court's analysis of the case. The district court said, in essence, that children have a liberty interest, for the Supreme Court of the United States said so in its decision in the case of Henry Gall. Hospitalization is a massive curtailment of that liberty, for again, the Supreme Court said so in Humphrey versus Cady. The district court then put the two together and concluded that these children were deprived of liberty interest without due process of law. Our position is that the district court's analysis is flawed because the district court focused on the wrong interest. It's a fundamental or threshold issue that in any litigation where what is challenged or what is alleged is a deprivation of a constitutionally protected interest, that you must look to the interest itself to see whether, in fact, it can be fairly said, as in this case, to fall within the ambit of the 14th Amendment. What we suggest to the court that the interest is here is the interest in the parent and the child to challenge his parent's medically indicated decision, for that is exactly what the district court is allowing the child to do by asserting that the child is deprived of a liberty interest by being hospitalized. It's our position that this analysis is inconsistent with both the inferences that can be drawn from this court's opinions, state court decisions, as well as the history of Western civilization. In our civilization, in our society, we've determined that children cannot make certain decisions for themselves. One of these areas in which we've made this determination is in the area of selecting medically indicated treatment. Both at common law and in the case law of this country, we have said that parents select medically indicated treatment for their children. Their children do not select that treatment themselves.
Is there a difference between mental and ordinary hospitals?
Is there a difference? Yes, sir. There is a difference.
For example, in the mental hospital, you are restrained.
Yes, sir. You are restrained in a sense. There's no denying that. I think the record in this case discloses that the
parent has a right to restrain a child.
Well, a parent has a right to restrain a child independent of this case, but I think what the record discloses
for
here...
For how long?
I suppose that parents restrain children until they reach their majority.
You couldn't restrain the child from school.
No, that's correct. You could not.
So it's not that broad, is it?
It's not absolute. Of course
not.
But
you do recognize the difference between the family's right to see that a child's tonsils are taken out as contrasted to being committed for the rest of his life.
I can see a difference in those two extremes, certainly, Your Honor. I would suggest that the point I'm trying to make here, quite honestly, sir, is that if there's a liberty interest in the child at all, to challenge his parents' decision to hospitalize him, that liberty interest must cut completely across the whole spectrum. It's not plausible to say that a constitutional right exists in a child when the child's parent wants to place him in a mental hospital.
Well, you don't suggest, I take it you don't suggest, maybe you do, that the parent's consent or decision is sufficient in itself.
I'm sorry, sir, I didn't understand your question.
Well, is it your submission that the child lacks a liberty interest to such an extent that the parent's decision standing alone is enough?
No, in this circumstance, the parent's decision standing alone is not enough. In actuality, in any case where what we're speaking of is medically indicated treatment, the parent's decision is not enough. The state.
What else must there be besides the parent's decision to hospitalize the child?
In this specific case, there must be the concurrence of a physician that what the parent desires for the child is actually what's in the child's best interest.
So somebody should look over the shoulder of the doctor and the parent, or not?
Our position is that no one should look over the shoulder of the doctor and the parent, or the doctor
together,
and the
child. If they act together.
Pardon me, sir?
If they act together.
And this physician could be an obstetrician?
Yes, sir. The law in Georgia and in most other states makes no difference between different practitioners of medicine. It simply defines them as physicians.
So, I mean, an obstetrician could say that this child is dangerous and needs mental treatment.
No, sir, he wouldn't have to say that the child's dangerous. All he'd have to say is that the child is mentally ill and suitable for treatment.
And he therefore becomes a, well, he's still an obstetrician.
Yes, sir, he could be an obstetrician.
What is done in practice, as a matter of fact? Do they use obstetricians for this purpose?
No, sir, they do not.
Going back to this dichotomy between mental and other diseases, if a parent puts a 9-year-old child in the hospital to have its appendix or tonsils taken out, do you suggest that that child could be released from the hospital by anyone except the consent of the parents and the hospital?
No, sir, and I don't think that that surgery could be authorized by anyone other than the parents. Or if the court found that the parents were acting in bad faith in denying the child the treatment he needed, of course the court could.
And if the hospital let the child out on the child's request, while still under care in the recuperative stages from the surgery, the hospital would surely be exposed to a malpractice suit, would they not?
Yes, sir, and I would expect that they would lose.
The hospital doesn't release any minor without the signature of the parent when it's, the child's been in the hospital for treatment. Isn't that so?
I believe so.
Do you know what the law in Georgia is on that?
The law in Georgia requires... I'm sorry, I don't have the specific site. I think it's 8819, Title 88, Chapter 19, has a consent law and requires the consent of parents before medical treatment can be rendered to children. Georgia Code Section 74.
And before they can be released from the hospital.
Georgia Code Section 74-104 makes parents explicitly responsible for the welfare and care of their children. And there's no law that says before a hospital can release a patient. I'm sorry, I'm going around your question, sir. There's no law.
I didn't want you to get out on what you didn't know what you were talking about.
There's no question that I cannot say, and I do not believe that there's a law that says that with respect to any facility, a hospital has to have parents' permission. There is a law here that says that if the child wants to leave, his leaving can be conditioned upon the consent of his parents. In this lawsuit, there is.
That's the mental law.
That's correct, sir.
Which is the one that's before us.
That's correct, and I'm not familiar with any similar requirement in the state, the medical treatment area. Let me get back to your question or your point, Mr. Chief Justice. What our point is if you say that there's a liberty interest here, then similarly, there's a liberty interest in that child who's going to have his tonsils taken out. I think we perhaps used a rather gruesome example in our reply brief, but I think it's appropriate. And that's the situation where a parent takes a child to a physician, and the physician says your child is exhibiting signs of cancer, the treatment for which is the removal of his leg. Under the very liberal definition of liberty that the district court applied, clearly the consequences of that parental decision is going to be to deprive the child of his liberty, again, as the district court has defined it. And as the United States noted in its amicus brief, it would be unprecedented to argue that the child has a liberty right, a right to due process in that situation. And in fact, no one argues that. They're simply arguing that in this particular case, mental illness, this child has a right to due process. No one argues that he would have that right in any other area. And we suggest that that's simply inconsistent with the way constitutional rights have been defined.
Well, to put it strictly, everybody has a right to due process, don't they? If they're going to be denied a liberty or property interest, you never reach the conclusion that the due process clause is not applicable to somebody. You can say that what was done did not deprive them of any liberty or property.
That's correct, sir. But at the point we are in the argument right now, it is our position that a child does not have a liberty right at all. At this point, vis-a-vis his parents, not vis-a-vis the state, constitutional rights, I believe you can say, do not exist in the abstract. They exist because of relationships. You might say that there's a constitutional right when you've got the parent or the child versus the state, as in the case of Henry Gall. But when you're talking about the parent and the child and the parent making the decision for the child, we say that there's no liberty interest, and that's where the court should have focused first and didn't. The district court should.
But, General, why don't you narrow it? The child still has some liberty rights.
Sir.
You just talked about the one liberty that's involved here.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
I mean, you keep broadening it out, and I wouldn't broaden it too much.
I certainly would not intend to say that the child does not have any liberty interest. Only a liberty interest not to challenge his parents' medically indicated decisions. That's how narrowly I want to define it, and I don't mean to broaden it anymore. However, even if the court decides that, in fact, there is a liberty interest here that could be protected, the second question is the one that was advanced by the court itself, and that's whether or not there's state action involved in this case. Now, the best way to address the state action question from our perspective is to consider what this court said in Burton versus Wilmington Parking Authority, and that is that you have to look at the case and sift the facts and circumstances to determine whether there's state action here. What we can say is that the challenge statute here does not authorize parents to provide medically indicated treatment for their children. It doesn't encourage it. We don't go out and seek the children. The best characterization of what we do is we provide a resource, and that is it. We provide a resource just as any private hospital would be a resource. We simply are fulfilling a proprietary function in this case. And as I said, our position is that it ought to be looked at from a practical standpoint. It seems impractical.
But you won't take the child just on the say-so of the parent and the parent's doctor?
That's correct, sir. We will not.
So you go through still a further procedure?
Sir. The way we have characterized it is that we do, in fact, have a gatekeeper. We do, in fact, have a gatekeeper. But what we do is we decide that...
And you decide the child that it's medically indicated to, or that treatment is indicated.
That's correct. We decide that the child meets the criteria of being mentally ill and suitable for treatment. But, of course, that's the same function that any doctor provides in any hospital. And what we're saying is that it seems illogical to say that if a parent has money, if he has assets, if he has resources, he can go to a private facility. And if the psychiatrist or the physician or whatever agrees with him, he can put his child in that hospital without going to a juvenile court proceeding, without going through an adversarial hearing. But if he doesn't have the money, if he doesn't have the assets, we're going to make him go to an adversarial proceeding. If he has to go to our juvenile court, get a lawyer for his child, or the court will appoint him, of course.
As to your gatekeeper, he can say no as to admission to a state facility where the parents and their doctor have said yes, but he cannot say yes if the parents or their doctor say no.
That's correct. That's really follows from what the court said in Jackson versus Metropolitan Edison. What we are doing is we're allowing a choice that the parent has to initiate. The parent has to initiate the action, or the guardian has to initiate the action that leads the child to the hospital.
What due process protection does the child have, in your view, if the parents are affluent and simply take the child to their own private psychiatrist or child specialist, and that doctor recommends commitment, and the commitment takes place in a private hospital? Any hearing?
No. That child receives absolutely nothing. He does what his parents tell him, and the parents, of course, decide what to do based on the doctor's advice. That I think that's our main point, that if in that case, that parent can put that child in that hospital, but here he's going to have to go through an adversarial process to achieve the same result, which is simply to get mental health treatment for his mentally ill child.
In the private hospital, it also is subject to habeas corpus, isn't it?
Yes, sir. And I think that the law would allow you to challenge the place and the reason for your detention, even in a private facility.
And if, apart from that, what would you think about the claim of the child that he was wrongfully committed for wrongful, improper reasons in a malpractice suit against the physician?
He would certainly have a false imprisonment suit against the physician. He could not sue his parents in Georgia.
Even if he didn't have one against his parents?
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, because of the existence of that possible liability, don't the private institutions follow precisely the same procedure the state institution does? Don't they examine before they admit?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes,
sir. So what is the discrimination?
The discrimination that I was addressing, if it exists at all, is one based on wealth, of course. And it's simply
the wealthy person must have, the wealthy parent can commit the child if the parent of the committing institution, I mean, if the doctor at the committing institution will receive the child. It's exactly what happens here. But you're saying that will continue to be the case, whereas the district court changed the rule
If the district court's order stands unchanged, will not be the instance with respect to the public hospitals. It will continue to be so with the private hospitals. There would be no reason for them to change that I'm aware of. The second issue with respect to state action, of course, is what happens once the child is in. I just want to briefly touch that and make the point that we made in our brief that our position is that once the child is in the facility, as long as he continues to meet the minimum criteria, we simply act as does any custodian of the child that the parent has entrusted his child to. We release the child when the parent wants the child. We don't release the parent, assuming these minimum conditions are met, if the parent wants the child to stay in. Even if the court finds that there is a liberty interest in state action here, of course, you still got the issue of what process is due.
One of these named plaintiffs, and I realize one of them is now deceased, but some members of this class were committed at the behest of the state as guardian.
That's correct, sir.
And in that category, there clearly is state action, I suppose. The state initiates it.
I concede state action.
You do concede it, sir?
Yes, sir.
So really, your argument is kind of moot, isn't it?
Well, sir, if I lose the argument on the children who are placed by state agencies and prevail on the state action on those children that are not, I will have succeeded, since the vast majority are admitted by their parents.
Right.
So even when the parents bring the child to the hospital, as soon as the state-employed physician, psychiatrist, enters and participates in the commitment, would you say that is or is not state action?
I would say that's of course state action. I would say that it does not rise to the level necessary to implicate the 14th Amendment.
Well, but it is state action at that stage.
I cannot deny that it's state action. It's state
in the same way that it's state action if the state was proceeding as a guardian ad litem for the child.
There's a different level or different quantum of state action, but yes, there's state action.
But it is part of your position that participation by the state, namely the doctor at the institution takes a look at the child, that's an essential condition to the deprivation of liberty. Assuming
it's a deprivation, it cannot be accomplished without the physician's approval.
And if it's essential because it's part of the regular procedure, and are you still arguing it's not state action?
I'm saying that it's not a progression. The parent's already decided that the child needs to be in the hospital.
But he can't get in the hospital unless the state examines him and says, yes, you can come in.
That's correct. But what the state is doing is the state is saying, it's simply affirming the parent's decision.
But your argument on the merits is that that's an essential part of the procedure.
I agree. That's correct, sir.
And you still say it's not state action.
Excuse me. Go ahead. Sorry.
It makes the state action very difficult.
And they not only don't let them in unless they agree, but then they implement the decision.
They do not let them. That's correct. They treat them. They treat them. Even if you find that there's liberty in state action, the question is what processes do. Our position on this is similar to Judge Roney's in his opinion in Drummond versus Fulton County Department of Family and Children's Services, where he said due process doesn't require in every instance an adversarial proceeding. It simply requires a rational decision-making process. In this case, what happens is a parent decides that a child is mentally ill for one reason or another. He decides it because of the child's outward behavior. He decides it because a physician tells him so. He brings the child to a hospital. And I'm simplifying the procedure. The record clearly discloses that almost uniformly, children are taken from the parents to the community mental health centers, and if they can be treated as outpatients, they're treated there, and then only if that fails are they brought to the hospital. But I'm simplifying it just for explanation. They bring the child to the hospital. The record clearly discloses that at the hospital, the child is examined by a team. They use a team approach, which may include a psychiatrist, a psychologist.
So the parent doesn't necessarily come to the hospital armed already with a physician's decision?
No. That's correct, sir. Okay. He does not.
He may come with the family physician, but then that's subject to screening by the state authority.
That's correct.
But the state will examine the child and take the child, even though there's no other medical opinion but the state's.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Isn't it true that in the average case, the only qualified psychiatrist is a state psychiatrist?
Yes, I would agree.
So, I mean, the ultimate decision as to the mentality of the child is made by the state doctor.
That's correct.
I mean, I don't say that harms your case or not, but that's true.
That's correct. I do not deny that. The point I was making is that it's a team approach when they come to the hospital. You've got, as I said, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, mental health therapists, who the record discloses contact schools, the community, the courts, the police, to try to get a picture. They talk to the child. They talk to his parents. And then they decide to admit it. And that's probably our biggest difficulty here. It just seems that that is clearly a rational decision-making process. The state has no stake in admitting the child. There's no proof that the child or that the state gets anything if the child's admitted. The record's clear that we did not operate at capacity in our hospitals. The record is replete with evidence on that basis. But even if the child is mistakenly hospitalized, even if the child's parents have the wrong motives and bring that child to the hospital, even if the doctors just completely do the wrong thing and admit the child still has access to the courts. And I think that that ought to be considered and hasn't been considered yet.
By what processes do you mean? Habeas corpus?
No, sir. They have habeas corpus, but that's not what they need to rely on. There is a specific provision in Georgia Code, Chapter 885, the Mental Health Code, that the children or that any patient can go to the probate court of the county and claim that the chapter is being abused, the code chapter.
Well, how does a 7-year-old child set those proceedings in motion?
Well, Your Honor, and I don't want to appear flip with my answer, but I would refer the court to its decision in Bellotti versus Baird, where the court, of course, had an abortion decision where the Massachusetts statute said that parents could be required to consent to the abortion, or that a child could be required to get his parents' consent. But if the child could not get his parents' consent, he could then go to the courts and get an order. She could then go to the courts and get an order authorizing the abortion, and it would appear that the 10, 11, 12-year-old child who is in this case would get to court the same way the 10, 11, or 12, 13-year-old girl would get to court in Pilate. The statute, the child need not rely expressly on that. There's also the provision in the code that requires DHR to provide access to counsel if the patients need it. The record will disclose, and I don't think the appellees dispute, that we provided office space for these attorneys in our mental health facility, and that it was our staff that referred these children to these lawyers. I think that the system in its totality demonstrates that children can get into court.
Let me take the reverse of Mr. Justice Marshall's hypothetical statement. Suppose the family physician and two private practitioners of psychiatry bring the child to the state and say, we think the child should be committed. And the state psychiatrist makes the usual examination and says, no, I think this child just needs outpatient treatment and I will not commit. That would be the end of the matter, would it not?
That's correct, sir.
No one could force the state
That's correct.
To take the child.
That's correct, sir.
You don't have mandamus down there?
Yes, but you can't mandamus someone to perform a discretionary function, and that's what this would be. They could mandamus him to perhaps examine the child, but they could not mandamus him to admit it. There's one issue that I don't want to get away from. I don't want to sit down without addressing it, and that's the substantive due process issue, because that I know I've spent a lot of time on the procedural question, but that's the nut of this case. That's why this case was brought in the first instance. And we think that the district court's decision there was incorrect and has to be reversed. What the district court has said to us in this substantive due process question is that if a parent brings a child to a state mental hospital and our physician examines that child and he says, this child is mentally ill, I can treat him in my hospital, I can give him some benefit, but if I had my choice, I'd send him to a group home or a specialized foster home, then we can't provide treatment for that child if we don't have that specialized foster home or that group home. What the district court has said is that if we're going to provide treatment for these children, we have to provide the treatment in the most appropriate treatment setting, and if we don't have it, we can't provide the treatment. Now, the absurdity of this is that if a parent, if an adult, rather, comes to our hospital and he's got schizophrenia, paranoid type, even if he's not appropriate for hospitalization in this case, they have adult foster homes. Even if he's not appropriate for hospitalization, he can go into that hospital because he's presumed to be able to assume the risk of going into the hospital. But under the district court's decision, if a child comes to that hospital with that exact same condition, we cannot put that child in the hospital. His parents cannot waive his constitutional rights under the district court's opinion, and that child will go without treatment until that child either degenerates to the point where hospitalization is appropriate or until the parent is able to find some private care for him. And that just doesn't seem to be a logical result to us. And it's certainly one that shouldn't be allowed in this case. It just is a result that should be avoided. And I know in our reply brief I accused the, I think it's perhaps the wrong word, but I mentioned a parade of horribles. And I don't want the court to think that that's what I'm doing here. Any fair reading of that district court's decision, particularly when coupled with the order denying the stay, makes it absolutely clear that the district court said, I find that every moment of inappropriate hospitalization of a child denies that child a substantive due process interest. Every moment of inappropriate hospitalization. And he found that it was inappropriate when we could think of some other treatment setting that was more appropriate.
Now, you think the under the order, the I think you were asked this earlier, the state may completely release the 46 children?
Yes, sir. There's no question in my mind that we can do that.
The state hasn't been ordered to provide them with the more yes, appropriate setting.
No, sir, but we do have a slight problem. Some of the 46 children that were at issue here are already in our custody.
Yes.
And with respect, that's why this issue is ripe. I noticed that several amici suggested that it's not, but they obviously were not aware of this thing that we do have custody of certain.
So you have been, with respect to them, you must provide, the state has been ordered to provide different treatment setting.
The most appropriate treatment setting, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Cromartie?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The issues in this case are very narrow, although difficult. I'd like in my argument to deal first with the procedural due process issue and then deal with the substantive due process issue if the court will permit.
Very specifically, would you explain, at least for my benefit, why the presentation of the child by the parents to the state psychiatrist and the processes that then occur is not sufficient due process?
All right, Your Honor, we feel that the process of examination by the superintendent is inadequate as a due process substitute for several reasons.
Well, first, the claim is not that it's a due process substitute, but that it's adequate under what is required by the Constitution, that it is due process.
But it's all
yes,
the process
Your
which is due in the
yes,
circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, I stand corrected on that. We feel that for several reasons, though, it's inadequate. First of all, it's not really a hearing at all. It is not processed. There is no notice to the child of what will happen during this interview. There is no requirement of looking at other resources in the test under the Georgia law. Virtually all of the information comes from the parents, and later in my argument I'll develop the conflicts of interest inherent between the parent and the child. That information is unverified and frequently inadequate that comes through that process. In essence, there's no structure whatsoever. Secondly,
are you suggesting that there is inherently and universally a conflict of interest between parent and child in this setting?
We feel that there's a substantial chance that there are conflicts of interest between parent and child inherently, yes, Your Honor. And I can get into that argument now and jump from the superintendent's argument.
Do it in your own order.
The superintendent's decision, though, is inadequate for a number of other reasons. The state has contended that the informality is adequate because of a comprehensive screening process that happens prior to coming to the hospital. The state's own witnesses established that screening process is inadequate. Dr. Philly testified that it's not mandatory, that screening process can be and is sometimes ignored. Dr. Philly testifies that the development of community screening resources are lagging far behind those of adults. And finally, you have the facts involving JL and JR. Both of them were screened by a community screening process, and the recommendations of their therapist was that they should not be hospitalized, and yet that recommendation was not even considered by the admitting physician. And I think that those facts go to show how inadequate that community screening process is. Next, we are relying on the fact of the uncertainty of diagnosis that this court has noted before in terms of psychiatrists, the tentativeness of professional judgment. We have expert witnesses who testified to the institutional biases that are reflected through the decision of institutional psychiatrists. And finally, the district court went to two of these facilities, looked at the admissions process, and they found that the admission process, as set up, does not provide due process protection. So for all of those reasons, we do not feel that the superintendent's decision is sufficient.
When you say the district court went to the hospitals and looked at the procedures, did one or more of the judges sit in on, say, an interview between the psychiatrist and the family? Or?
I don't know of any interviews that they sat in on. All three judges, Judge Bell, Judge Boodland, but Judge Owens, visited two of the facilities, one at the choice of the defendant and one at the choice of the plaintiff. And they state in their decision that during those days that they were visiting the facilities that they talked with state employees and talked with patients. And during that process talked about the admissions procedures, about the treatment in there, all of these issues. But I don't think there's anything in the record to indicate that they actually sat in on the interviews themselves.
Did either of the parties have an opportunity to cross-examine the judges about their observations? Was there any adversary process?
No,
attending the judge's view?
Other than the exchanges that occurred during the hearings, there were several hearings that took place, but there was no right to cross-examine the judge, and I know of no such right. But that did not occur.
What would your idea be of an adequate hearing? Starting off, do you need a judge?
Your Honor, we don't feel that the court needs to reach that issue, but if the court decides to reach the issue, we think that at least some sort of deliberation, some impartial hearing examiner, whether they be a judge or whether they be other professional, might well suffice. We focus in
a state psychiatrist?
It perhaps could even be a state psychiatrist.
Well, don't you have that at times?
Your Honor, you have a state psychiatrist in the same institution, and Dr. Messenger testified very clearly that there are institutional biases at work there.
Well, what is the bias, that they want more people?
Your Honor, the testimony was from Dr. Messenger was that frequently psychiatrists in an institution tend to over-institutionalize. They tend to...
Did he also testify that it's hardly possible to get two psychiatrists degree on anything?
Well, that's a part of the unreliability of the whole process, the danger. I would much prefer that the hearing be held in front of a judge or at least some other substitute such as that.
Now, all of these defects and doubts that you're now talking about are equally applicable, I suppose, when the question is whether an adult shall be received into one of these hospitals, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the same uncertainty about the science of psychiatry and the same biases,
yes, Your
Honor, pro-institutional biases on the part of psychiatrists and so on. And there's no claim that when an adult presents himself after having consulted with a doctor, that anything is required beyond what's presently accorded, is there?
You're speaking of a voluntary admission.
Yes, I'm speaking of a voluntary admission. So this case really boils down, parses down, doesn't it, to the claim that the understanding of the law that's existed for centuries, that a parent makes decisions for his minor child, and is invalid.
Your Honor, we don't feel that parents have been able to institutionalize their children in state mental institutions for centuries.
Well, hasn't that been the presumption of the law for forever, the Anglo-Saxon law, now there's matters of definition. What is a child? I suppose the law has never said that a person 35 years old is still a child. But setting aside those problems of definition, hasn't the law always been that a parent makes decisions for his or her minor child, where that child's going to be educated, how that child's going to be punished, where that child, when and if the child is going to go to the hospital, what yeah. time the child's going to go to bed, what time he's going to get up, what time he's going to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Hasn't
yes,
that
Your Honor,
always
that...
been the implicit recognition of the law in our society?
The explicit recognition, I would think. The,
well, both.
The traditional way that we protect children is through the parents. And we are asking the court here, under these very narrow circumstances, that is institutionalization in a mental hospital, mm-hmm. that the traditional way we protect children is not valid here. And we think that the evidence in this case clearly leads to that sort of conclusion. If I may review some of that.
So the gist here is that your attack is on that basic presumption in this context, isn't it?
I think it has
because
to
it's,
be.
Because there's no attack at all on the procedures insofar as they're applicable to adults.
No, Your Honor, there's not. There, of course, the difference between those two, I think, is that in the case of an adult, of course, it is truly voluntary. I mean,
well, this is voluntary if you presume that a parent can speak for his child. This is
yes,
purely
Your Honor.
Voluntary.
Part of our argument is that the traditional protections, though, for the child are not here under these instances. And let me review for you.
Before you get to that review, tell me if you would, or if you prefer to do it after the review, how you distinguish the hospitalization in a mental facility from hospitalization for the tonsillectomy or for appendectomy and that sort of thing.
There are a number of reasons that it's different. One, the stigma of institutionalization in a mental institution far transcends any stigma that might be attached to the regular hospital. And secondly, the very essence of treatment in a mental institution is confinement. That's the purpose of putting somebody in a maximum security mental hospital, is to confine them, to deprive them of their liberty.
Well, certainly while you're recovering from a serious operation, you're confined in a hospital in the same way you're confined in a mental institution.
That is incidental to the treatment, and historically we have treated the two very differently.
Well, isn't the confinement in a mental hospital incidental to and the very function of the treatment?
I think not. I think that the reason that you would be in a state mental institution rather than some alternative facility, less restrictive facility, would be for the confinement itself. And there's testimony from Dr. Hodges and others that that's what you're talking about in the mental facility itself. Now, I'm not talking about the community facilities or that sort of thing. But historically, the law has treated the two differently. And Sam Brackle, in his book for the American Bar Association, has pointed out that historically, our law has required very strict requirements in terms of placing people in state
mental
institutions.
Well, these are voluntary. Is this true for voluntary, so-called voluntary commitments? Because that's what we're dealing with here.
Voluntary commitment is a relatively new
phenomenon. And has the law set up all sorts of processes in connection with voluntary commitment?
Not for adults.
No. So the basis, your attack is on this, on the basic proposition that's been accepted, that a parent makes decisions for his child.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you say that the parent cannot make the decision here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, who can?
We think that a hearing examiner or whoever the state decides should make the decision right now under the way
the state has decided.
Well, there are different ways, like we have got
then you're not satisfied with the person the state has picked. The state has already picked somebody.
We don't think that it's adequate. I mean, our two named plaintiffs are perfect examples of why it's not adequate, too. Both of them were recommended by their primary therapist not to go in an institution, and yet this process provided them with absolutely no protections. And if I might get to...
He did have protections. He could have gotten a lawyer.
If he finally did after 5 years in a mental institution. Yes,
I didn't want to put that extra icing on it, but he did get a lawyer.
Well, fundamentally, we don't think that a young child, 6 or 7 years old, could be expected isolated.
Who should speak for that child at 6 and 7 years old?
Well, if there were a hearing, there can be a lawyer appointed, there can be a guardian ad litem appointed, there would be somebody.
Well, how would that be brought about?
Through a process of automatically giving hearings.
So the state appoint somebody to be the guardian. You couldn't go behind that, could you?
No, Your Honor, unless
the
guardian...
Well, the state here said that this committee at the institution shall determine it.
Yes, Your Honor.
And now you tell me that that's wrong. I want to know why. Well, why isn't that group as expert as the parent?
Well, they found...
On the question of insanity and mental illness.
The court found that the process in and of itself was inadequate because of the institutional biases, because of the tentativeness of judgment. Those reasons, the court found that it was inadequate.
Ain't going to turn the children loose.
That's not the only alternative here. There are other alternatives. The question is whether they are in need of treatment in a maximum security mental hospital. No question, there are other places that the children could be placed. There are other alternatives.
But your whole argument from the outset makes parents, as such, a suspect class by saying that your statement that there is an inherent conflict between the interests of the child and the interests of the parent, and that that must be flushed out in some proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor, and if I might address that for a minute, our evidence in this case shows that all of these situations involve stressful home situations, emotionally charged home situations. That was the testimony of all of the experts. Parents cannot, under those circumstances, be expected to be totally objective about the process. Secondly, every expert in this case, including all of the superintendents of the hospitals, testified that the pathology of the child is inextricably related to the pathology of the parents. That is, the parents themselves are a part of the problem that is going on here in the vast majority of cases.
Well, in the state, your colleague, your friend on the other side, doesn't contend that the state can just take the parent's word and put the child in the hospital?
There is that further step, Your Honor.
Well, there's always going to be medical advice. Now, I think your problem is to convince us that the medical advice or the procedures at the hospital aren't adequate. Because none of those people take the word of the parent. Just say, do you want your child treated? We'll treat him.
Your Honor, we feel that the record is replete with instances of where that stage is inadequate. For instance, a psychiatrist does not necessarily even see the child before the child is placed in the institution. Dr. Gates testified that sometimes no psychiatrist even sees the child until later, until the decision is already made to commit the child. They rely so heavily on this elaborate community screening to provide them with adequate information. They themselves admit that the procedure at the hospital itself is very, very informal and I think subject to error. What they claim, though, to substitute for that is this elaborate community screening process outside the hospital. And yet Dr. Philly, who's head of the thing, testified that that component is lagging way, way behind. It is not always followed. In fact, frequently it's not followed.
What you've really said here is that the parents are suspect, the institutional psychiatrists are suspect. Would it satisfy your notions of due process if the court had designated in each community a panel of 10 psychiatrists, or as many as were available, and that the institutional psychiatrist plus one of the outside psychiatrists picked at random would make the decision? Would that take care of due process?
Because that issue is not...
You can respond to that after you had a chance to think about it during lunch hour. Resume. I think we had a question pending.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Prior to the break, the Chief Justice had asked me the question as to whether it would be different if there were a panel of 12 psychiatrists and one of those 12 participated in the decision-making process, would that satisfy our need for a hearing, if I understood the question correctly?
It was only 10.
Only 10, all right. I don't think that the two would be material anyway. My response to that would be no, not as long as the process were set up the same as it is right now. Our basic position is that the process right now does not protect the child's interest in terms of sifting the facts, sifting through the facts. There's no opportunity for the child to cross-examine what has allegedly been his conduct. There are no statewide standards or procedures where the child knows what the rules of the game are.
Well, you're assuming, of course, two things there. The child is concerned with what you call the rules of the game, and second, that rules in the sense of that implies an adversary-type proceeding may be the worst thing in the world for a child in these circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor, because we do not feel that the court has to reach the issue of the rules, because all the court said was your procedure has no protections in it whatsoever, and look to other state laws that do provide some protection for children and do involve commitment of children to mental institutions, and said use those in the interim. If the legislature wants to come in and set up other provisions, then they're free to do that under the court's decision. But the court's pointed to the Juvenile Court Code, which does allow the child to have a hearing and yet takes care of the very trauma issues that you raise. That is, it has provisions in there to help deal with any alleged trauma that might take place. There is a provision there for excusing the child from the hearing at certain times. There's a provision for appointment of a guardian ad litem to make sure that the child's interests are adequately protected. The court did not specify what additional protections would be needed. It simply said the Georgia procedure as it presently exists is not enough. There needs to be more.
It certainly implied that the juvenile court procedures were adequate, didn't it?
Well, that they were available and that they did provide some type of hearing, yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And
in fact,
one-third
of the children in Georgia that
are committed through
committed,
those procedures.
Yes,
and then
Your
there's
Honor.
Another procedure, the ordinary court, court in ordinary.
Yes, Your Honor. That is how adults are normally institutionalized.
What's that called, the ordinary court?
The court of ordinary.
Court of ordinary?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is that, like a probate court? Or?
It's a probate court, Your Honor. And children could be committed through that. In fact, they are frequently.
Your objection to a panel of psychiatrists, 10 or 12, I suppose, would be that they're not, that they have this pro-institutional bias and these, they would not be neutral hearing officers. Is that it?
Well, if they were non-institutional psychiatrists,
outside psychiatrists, I think
that it might well comport with due process as long as there were some procedures, some opportunity for the child or the child's representative.
I thought your point was that there ought to be a procedure for cross-examining the experts, the psychiatrists.
Cross-examining whatever data is brought before those psychiatrists. Right now, the child is institutionalized because of data that comes from the community that says the child did such and so, his demeanor has been such and such in school. And there's no chance for the child to confront that and to say, no, that's not the way it was.
You mean a four-year-old child?
Or a representative for that child.
How could the representative say what the child did or did not do?
The representative can investigate and cross-examine the people and see whether that is, it's done every day. And we feel strongly in terms of the age of the children, that a 4 or a 5 or a 6-year-old, that there has to be protection there too. It's dramatically illustrated by the two children that are named plaintiffs.
That are named plaintiffs are wrongfully there. There are two other ways you could have gotten them out in Georgia.
Yes, Your Honor.
In very short order.
Habeas corpus with lies.
But you didn't do it.
No, Your Honor, we didn't. We feel that preventing inappropriate hospitalization would not be accomplished by a case-by-case habeas approach. The children are not going to know about those remedies. I mean, they're not going to have the wherewithal to use those remedies. A lot of the balancing that I'm talking about right here under the Matthews-Eldridge test requires that you look at all elements. And I really have not talked about the magnitude of the child's interest. But we're talking about here two children that were hospitalized for 5.5 years in an institution, and now their own psychiatrists are saying they don't even need to be there. Their outpatient therapist said they didn't need to be there in the first place. That's a rather enormous interest that we're talking about right here.
But maybe, and I say maybe, that's, while they don't need to be there, conceivably that might be the best place for them among the various options now available in Georgia, including their own families or some other hospital or some other institution or possibly a foster family, but maybe it'd be impossible to find foster families.
It's ironic to me that I was furnished a list this morning. There were 46 kids that the state has consistently said there's nothing we can do with these children. There are no alternatives for them. And yet all but two of them are out of the institution now, and they haven't built any new facilities. There are other alternatives available. And I think that this due process hearing that we're talking about, whatever the particular form might be, would center in on that one thing. It would be well worth the effort. That is, in the community, to look at what other alternatives are available and to look at that in the community and to see if there are other alternatives available.
How does Georgia define that child? At what age? What age is we talking about? Up to what age?
Well, we're talking about through age 17.
Through age 17. Is that statutory definition in Georgia?
Yes,
up to the 18th birthday.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And from then on, over 18, it's an adult for this purpose under Georgia law.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
What you're postulating here is some sort of at least quasi-adversary proceeding, and which, as I hear your argument, would be a four-sided sort of procedure. The parents, the child, the experts, the doctors, the medical experts, clinical psychologists, and the guardian ad litem. And you suggest that putting a child through that four-sided kind of adversary procedure is not going to have an irreversible traumatic effect on the child?
You know, I can't imagine any more trauma on a child than what J.L. and J.R. have gone through for the past 5 years to be dumped, and literally dumped into an...
That's an overstatement, isn't it?
Your Honor, the testimony of Dr. Messenger is that he had never seen a more classic, more clear-cut example of parents dumping a child than the case of J.L. But getting to your question, there is an amicus curiae brief before the court right now. New Jersey, the Supreme Court has mandated just such a procedure there. And their experience has been that, in fact, these hearings have been therapeutic in terms of the parent-child relationship. It's no mystery to children that there are conflicts within the family. I mean, children's judgment may not be totally intact, but children's, and I know from having several of them, that children's perceptions are very good. I mean, even a five-year-old has very good perception. They can pick up conflict. They know there's conflict with their parents. They know there's conflict there. The hearing can actually be traumatic, can be therapeutic if done, say, the way we do it in our juvenile court right now. Now, I can't say how juvenile courts work around the country, but I know in Georgia, our juvenile court works, and it works well. I mean, I think we have kept the best of both, and I've had a lot of practice in juvenile court. We have managed to keep it informal enough to where nobody is traumatized by the process, and yet it's formal enough to adequately protect the rights of the people. Your Honor, I think it can be done.
May I ask you whether you expect to reach what's been called a substantive due process issue?
I will now, Your Honor.
You don't have very much time left.
I will now. We don't feel that the state has categorized the issue correctly. At page 135 of the court's opinion, it made very clear that what it was finding here was that by the state's own admission that there were 46 children who did not need to be in a hospital, and secondly, that they were being harmed by a continued stay in that hospital. And what the court did, it took the Jackson versus Indiana test and said that if you're going to hold children, there's got to be some relationship between the holding and what you're trying to do for them. I think that the court's holding is very, very limited, much more limited than what the state would categorize it as. It's a very limited holding.
You don't read the decree then as the particularly the italicized portion on page 54A as requiring the state to spend money if necessary to build these facilities as something that must be complied with, even though the state would prefer to simply turn the children loose from any confinement?
It was a ruling that applied to 46 named specific children.
Well, with respect to them, how do you construe the ruling?
That they were to do what was necessary to relieve the unconstitutional condition that existed.
Could they relieve it by simply releasing them from custody?
I think they probably could.
And
I think
is that the way you read the decree?
That is the way the state has. And
is
I
it
think
the it, way you read it?
Yes, Sean.
Mr. Cromwell, what is the source of the court's power to order the state of Georgia to spend money for this project?
Well, I think the court was convinced in its own mind that the state of Georgia didn't have to spend anything, that it would actually be cheaper to have these children in less expensive resources.
But they did command them to spend money, did they not?
No, Your Honor, they said if that was what was necessary, spend the money. The court had told them several times, we don't think that you have to spend any money. We think it's cheaper to have these children in less restrictive, less confining environments.
Mr. Cromartie, I might just ask one question about what's going to happen next after the case leaves this court. One of the briefs filed by one of the associations suggests that there should be an exemption for intact families, pre-adolescent children, and for commitments for short periods of time, at least when all those conditions are met. Could that be done consistently with the manner in which the case was disposed of below, or does that require... Well, how much flexibility is there in what goes on next? I guess that's what I'm really asking.
There's a good bit of flexibility in what the court did, because it really didn't say this is what is required, X, Y, and Z, because the APA brief agreed that the Georgia procedures were invalid. What they said was with an intact family for a short period of time for an accredited institution for a pre-adolescent child, the balancing may be different there. And clearly the district court...
But under the holding of the district court, is the procedure invalid even as applied to that narrow category? I suppose it is.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.